Welcome back to the deep dive. I was sitting here setting up for the recording, checking the mic levels, connecting to the server, making sure my cloud notes were syncing, and it hit me.
What's that?
We are just completely surrounded by this invisible, incredibly complex infrastructure that we just expect to work. I tap a piece of glass and a movie plays. I press a button and I'm talking to someone in Tokyo.
It just works phenomenon. We treat technology like a utility. You flip a switch, the light comes on. You don't really think about the power plant or the grid.
But for this deep dive, we are going to break that illusion. We are going to stop taking it for granted and actually look under the hood. We're basing this on a really comprehensive stack of notes covering systems, architecture, networking protocols, and modern development stacks.
So the mission today is to deconstruct the black box.
That's it.
We're going to peel back the layers. We'll start right at the bottom, the raw silicon and electricity, and work our way up through the operating systems, the virtualization that powers the cloud, the networking,
The stuff that ties it all together.
and finally, the software stack that you, the user, actually interact with.
And I want to make sure by the end of this, we aren't just throwing out buzzwords. I want to understand why a developer chooses, say, a container over a virtual machine. Or, why my gaming connection uses a different language than my email.
We can definitely do that. Think of this as an architectural tour of the modern world.
All right, let's start in the basement then, the engine room, the hardware itself. We all know the CPU is the brain. But I feel like that analogy, it simplifies things a bit too much.
It does. It really does. The CPU, or central processing unit, is really the executor. It's the master coordinator. It takes instructions, fetch, decode, execute, and runs them in a sequence. It's incredibly fast, but it's generally designed to do things one after another.
It's serial processing.
Exactly. So it's like a brilliant mathematician solving these super complex calculus problems, but doing them one at a time.
Okay, but in the last decade, we've seen the rise of a partner that is almost eclipsing the CPU in certain areas.
The GPU, right? The graphics processing unit.
Which historically, that was just for making video games look pretty, right? Rendering textures and lighting.
Originally, yes. But here's the key insight. To render a 3D image, you need to change the color of millions of pixels at the same time. That requires parallel processing. So if the CPU is that solitary genius mathematician,
The GPU is like 1,000 elementary school students solving 1,000 simple addition problems all at the exact same time.
that's a perfect analogy. And that architecture, that parallel processing, turned out to be exactly what we needed for AI and deep learning.
Of course.
Precisely. Neural networks are essentially just a massive matrix multiplication problems. They are parallel by nature. So the GPU graduated from just rendering explosions in video games to, well, powering the entire AI revolution.
Okay, so we have the thinkers, the CPU, and GPU, but they need to talk to the rest of the machine. In the research, I saw these terms North Bridge and South Bridge. They sound like locations on a map, but they're chipsets, right?
They are. They're the traffic controllers on the motherboard. And the distinction is all about speed. The North Bridge is the high-speed expressway. It connects the CPU directly to the things it needs instant access to:
Things like.
the memory, so the RAM, and the graphics card.
Because if the CPU has to wait for data, the whole system just hangs.
Exactly. Latency is the enemy. The South Bridge, on the other hand, that's the scenic route. It handles the slower input-output stuff.
Your USB mouse, your keyboard.
The audio, the hard drives, yeah, they are slow compared to the CPU, so they just don't need that expressway access.
That makes sense. You segregate the high-speed traffic from the local delivery trucks. Now, you mentioned RAM connected to the North Bridge. I think most people know more RAM is better, but let's define what it actually is.
RAM is random access memory. And the most critical characteristic to remember is that it's volatile.
Meaning, if I pull the plug, it's all gone.
Instantly, think of RAM as your workbench. You pull tools and files out of the cabinets to work on them. You can access them instantly because they're right in front of you. But at the end of the day, when you power down, that workbench gets wiped clean.
And the physical form varies. I saw dim and so dim in the notes.
That's mostly just form factor. DIMM, dual inline memory module, is that long stick you click into a desktop motherboard. SUDIMM is just the smaller version for laptops. Same concept, different size.
But we also have non-volatile memory, ROM.
Right, read-only memory. This is the stone tablet of the computer. It stores the firmware or BIOS. This is the software that is literally hard-coded into the chip. When you press the power button, the computer doesn't know how to be a computer yet.
It's a blank slate.
The ROM tells it, here's how you wake up, here's how you find the hard drive, here's how you start Windows.
So ROM starts the machine, RAM runs the active tasks, then we have the filing cabinets, permanent storage. And we've seen a huge shift here from HDDs to SSDs.
Oh, this is probably the single biggest performance upgrade in the last 15 years. We moved from hard disk drives, which literally has spinning magnetic platters and a mechanical arm that had to physically move.
I remember the sound they made, that clicking.
Exactly, to solid-state drives.
Which are flash memory, no moving parts.
Right. HDDs were slow, fragile, noisy. SSDs are silent, durable, and just incredibly fast. But here is the technical nuance. For a long time, we were plugging these super-fast SSDs into the old, slow connections designed for those spinning disks.
We were bottlenecking them.
Completely. That's why you see the term NVMe now, Non-Volatile Memory Express. It's a protocol that allows the SSD to connect directly to the PCIe bus, basically connecting the storage straight to that high-speed Northbridge Expressway we talked about. It just unlocks the true speed of the drive.
So we've built the engine room. We have processors, memory, and fast storage. But a pile of hardware is useless without a manager. We need to move up the stack to the operating system.
The OS, the great abstraction layer. It sits between the hardware and you. You don't want to have to tell the hard drive specifically which sector to write a 1 or a 0 to.
You just want to save a file.
Exactly. The OS translates your save click into the millions of electrical signals required to make it happen.
And we're all familiar with the big names, Windows, macOS, Linux.
Those are the desktop titans. And they are designed for flexibility. You can swap out hardware, install drivers for a new printer, or upgrade your graphics card. They're very modular.
But then we have the mobile OSs, Android and iOS. Aside from just being on a phone, how are they fundamentally different from a computing perspective?
They're a lot more opinionated.
Yeah.
They are optimized for three things: touch interfaces, extreme power management because they run on batteries, and tight integration with specific sensors.
Like GPS, accelerometers, that kind of thing.
And cameras, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this creates a real headache for developers, doesn't it? The fragmentation problem. It's the classic trade-off. If you are building an app, do you build it native? Meaning you write one version in Swift for Apple and a whole other version in Kotlin for Android.
Which doubles your work.
It doubles your cost, your maintenance, everything. But gives you perfect performance and access to all the hardware features.
Mm-hmm.
The alternative is cross-platform tools. But you sometimes lose that snappy native feel. And then you have to deal with platform-specific bugs.
Oh, that sounds frustrating.
You might write code that works perfectly on a Pixel phone, but then it crashes on a 3-year-old Samsung because of how they tweak their version of Android.
So let's talk about a way to solve that it works on my machine problem. We need to talk about virtualization. This feels like the backbone of the modern cloud.
It absolutely is. Virtualization is the ability to run a guest computer inside a host computer.
And the magic wand here is something called the hypervisor.
Correct. The hypervisor is the software that sits between the hardware and the virtual machines. It tricks the virtual machines into thinking they have their own CPU and RAM.
When they really don't.
While it actually manages the resources in the background, yeah.
The notes distinguish between type 1 and type 2.
Think of type 2 as what you might do at home. You have Windows installed, you download VirtualBox, and you run a little Linux window inside it. That's hosted. It's running on top of an OS.
Okay, so type 1 is?
Type 1 is bare metal. Imagine a massive data center server. You don't install Windows on it first. You install the hypervisor directly on the hardware. Then you can slice that one giant server into, say, 50 small virtual servers for 50 different customers.
That's the cloud.
That's the cloud.
Okay, so that's a virtual machine, a VM. But the industry seems to be moving toward containers. Docker is the big name here. What's the fundamental difference between a VM and a container?
This is a crucial distinction. A virtual machine is like a standalone house. It has its own foundation, its own plumbing, its own heating. It contains a full copy of an operating system. It's heavy.
It takes minutes to boot up.
Right. A container is more like an apartment in a high-rise. You have your own private living space, your application, and its libraries. But you share the foundation, the plumbing, and the heating with the rest of the building.
So you share the host OS kernel.
You share the host OS kernel. They are orders of magnitude lighter. You can spin up a container in milliseconds. And importantly, they are standardized. If a container works on my laptop, it is guaranteed to work on the server because it carries its whole environment with it.
Ah, that's the shipping container analogy. It doesn't matter if it's on a boat, a train, or a truck, the container just fits.
Exactly. It completely revolutionized how we deploy software.
And before we leave this layer, there was a mention of sandboxing. Is that related?
It is. A sandbox is a safety technique. It's an isolated virtual environment. If you download a suspicious file and you aren't sure if it's a virus,
you open it in the sandbox.
Yeah. If it detonates, it only destroys the sandbox, not your actual operating system.
It's like a bomb disposal chamber. Smart. Okay, we have the hardware, the OS, and the virtualized environments. But they are islands unless we connect them. Segment 4, the nervous system. Networking.
The invisible wires that run the world.
Let's clear up some hardware confusion first. Hub versus switch versus router. I feel like people use these interchangeably.
They definitely shouldn't. A hub is the oldest and, frankly, the dumbest of the three. It's passive. If data comes in for one computer, the hub just shouts it out to every single computer plugged into it.
So a hub is a town crier. Inefficient.
And a security nightmare. A switch is smarter. It operates at what we call layer 2. It has a table of M addresses, the physical ID cards of your devices. When data comes in for your laptop, the switch sends it only to the port your laptop is plugged into.
Much better. And the router.
The router is the gateway. It connects different networks together, usually your home network, your LAN, to the internet, the WAN. It operates at layer 3 using IP addresses. It's the traffic cop deciding the best path for data to travel across the globe.
Okay, so that's the hardware. Now the languages they speak, the protocols. The big two are TCP and UDP. Why do we need two?
It all comes down to a choice. Do you want reliability or do you want speed?
Give me the reliability pitch first. That's TCP.
That's TCP, Transmission Control Protocol. Think of it like sending a registered letter. You establish a connection, a handshake, you send the data, the receiver acknowledges they got it. If a packet goes missing, TCP notices and resends it. It guarantees that the file you download is 100% complete.
Which is essential for things like email, web pages, or banking. You can't have missing numbers in a bank transfer.
Absolutely not. But all that checking takes time. So enter UDP, User Datagram Protocol. This is connectionless, like firing a machine gun of data. You just spray the packets at the target. You don't check if they arrived. You just keep sending.
That sounds chaotic. Why would we ever use that?
Real-time applications, voice over IP, streaming video, online gaming. If you're playing a shooter game and a packet containing your position from half a second ago gets lost, you don't want the game to pause and wait for it.
It's old news.
It's old news. You just want the next packet. You prioritize speed over perfect accuracy.
That's a great distinction. Now, these protocols connect to ports.
Right. Think of an IP address as the street address of a building. The port is the specific apartment number you're trying to visit.
So the server is the building.
Exactly. If you want to see a web page, you knock on apartment 80, which is HTTP, or apartment 443, which is HTTPS. If you want to send an email, you go to apartment 25 for SMTP. If you want to securely control the server,
you use port 22, SSH.
Correct. It just helps the server organize what kind of traffic is coming in.
And helping us find these addresses are DNS and DHCP.
The logistics team.
Yeah.
DNS, the domain name system, is the phone book. Humans are bad at remembering strings of numbers like 172.217.1.1. We are good at remembering google.com. DNS translates the name to the number.
Simple enough. And DHCP.
Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. That's the greeter at the door. When you walk into a coffee shop and join the Wi-Fi, you don't have to manually configure your IP address. DHCP automatically assigns your phone a unique address so you don't conflict with the person drinking a latte next to you.
It's incredible how much automation happens in the split second before I even load a web page.
And we haven't even talked about the web page itself yet.
Let's go there. Segment 5, the stack in the software sense. Developers are always talking about their tech stack.
A tech stack is just the combination of tools, languages, and frameworks used to build an application. And we usually split it into two parts, front end and back end.
Front end is the showroom, what you see.
Right. HTML for structure, CSS for style, and JavaScript for interactivity. Nowadays, people use frameworks like React or Angular to make that easier.
And the back end is the factory behind the doors.
The server, the application logic, and of course, the database.
We have some famous acronyms here, LeMon and MERN.
MMP is the grandfather of the web. Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP. It powered the early internet. Facebook and WordPress were built on this. It's stable, reliable.
But the cool kids are using MERN now.
MERN is a full-stack JavaScript approach. MongoDB, Express, React, Node. And the big idea there is, since it uses JavaScript for both the front end and the back end, you only need one language for the whole project.
The big shift there seems to be the database. MySQL versus MongoDB. This is the whole SQL versus NoSQL debate.
This is a huge architectural decision. SQL databases like MySQL are relational. Think of them like incredibly strict Excel sheets. You have rows and columns. You have to define exactly what data goes where. If you want to add a new type of data, you have to restructure the whole table.
It's rigid but consistent. Great for financial ledgers.
Perfect for that. NoSQL like MongoDB is document-based. It's flexible. You dump data in as JSON documents. One user might have a name and an email. The next user might have a name, an email, and a list of 10 hobbies. The database doesn't care. It just stores it.
So it scales better for messy, unstructured data.
Exactly. It's designed for the speed and variety of modern big data.
We are nearing the top of the pyramid here. We've built the app, but we need to make sure it doesn't crash or get hacked. Segment 6, security and scalability.
These are often called non-functional requirements, which is a terrible name because they are absolutely functional. I mean, security is non-negotiable.
We're living in a malware zoo. We know viruses attach to files, but what distinguishes a worm or a Trojan?
A virus needs a host file to spread. A worm is standalone. It's self-replicating. It scans the network, finds a vulnerability, copies itself, and moves on. They're terrifyingly fast.
And a Trojan.
Just like the wooden horse. It looks like a legitimate program, maybe a game or a PDF converter, but once you install it, it opens a backdoor for attackers.
And the modern plague, ransomware.
Which encrypts your data and demands crypto to unlock it. The defense against all this is hardening. You reduce your attack surface, you close those ports we talked about if you weren't using them, you patch your OS, you use firewalls.
And finally, scalability. If our app goes viral, how do we handle the traffic?
You have two choices, vertical scaling or horizontal scaling.
What's the difference?
Vertical scaling is scale up. You just buy a bigger server, more RAM, more CPU. It's easy, but there's a limit. Eventually, you can't buy a bigger machine.
So you scale out.
That's horizontal scaling. You buy more servers. You run your app on 10 or 100 or 1,000 small machines. This is where the cloud and those containers really shine. If traffic spikes, you just spin up 50 more containers instantly. When traffic drops, you turn them off.
It's elastic.
Exactly, and it's much more resilient. If one giant server fails, you go offline. If one of 100 small servers fails, the other 99 just pick up the slack.
So let's look at the full picture. We started with electrons moving through silicon in the Northbridge. We managed them with an OS kernel. We virtualized that into containers. We connected them via routers and TCP. We built an app on the MERN stack with a NoSQL database. And we hardened it with firewalls and horizontal scaling.
When you say it all in one breath, it sounds impossible that it works at all.
It really does.
But that is the beauty of abstraction. Each layer handles its own complexity, so the layer above it doesn't have to worry about it. The app developer doesn't need to know how the electrons move in the CPU. They trust the stack.
I want to leave the listener with a thought from the research that really stuck with me. Just think about the simple act of clicking a link.
It's a symphony. You click. An interrupt signal fires to the CPU. The OS pauses the current process. The network card wakes up. DHCP checks your lease. DNS converts the name to an IP. A TCP handshake shoots across the ocean via fiber optics. A load balancer hits a server cluster. A container spins up. Node.js queries a MongoDB database. The data flows back, gets reassembled, and your GPU renders the pixels.
And it happens in milliseconds.
Faster than a blink. We are leveraging billions of transistors and decades of engineering for every single click.
So the next time the Wi-Fi is a little slow.
Maybe give it a break. It's doing a lot of heavy lifting.
I'll try to remember that. Thanks for helping us decode the black box today.
It is a pleasure.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next deep dive.